Hello and welcome to Inside Education. We're online at insideed.com. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on this week's programme.
The most important element of the school system is, and it's no surprise if you think about it, is the quality of the teacher.
A man who relishes in being an upstart discusses his time at the helm of the University of Limerick and describes the steps he would take to improve our education system. But we begin this week with physical education. The subject was in the news during the week when Senator Eamon Coughlan drew attention to the problem of many young children today being overweight or obese and the need for schools to help solve the problem. But is there a difference between the school subject, physical education, and a programme of physical fitness? In order to find out more about this topic, I spoke to Katrina Cosgrave, who is a lecturer in physical education in the Merino Institute of Education. She is also the chairperson of the Irish Primary PE Association. I began by asking Katrina to summarise Eamon Coughlan's concerns.
Eamon's concern, Sean, is really that he wanted to heighten awareness around physical fitness for children and young people in terms of their lives and school curriculum, primarily from a health awareness and a health perspective, and that he had a concern that that this wasn't happening, that the school system wasn't supporting a system where children could become physically fit as young children and as adolescents.
As an expert in physical education, what would you advise a school who is concerned about the children's fitness to do in order to improve their fitness?
In my opinion, really, the fitness thing would have to be taken much broader. You'd have to have a high quality physical education programme, which would mean, you know, staff being feeling adequately trained to be able to deliver on a broad range of activities, but also a whole school approach to physical activity in general. So whether that be during yard time, after school, prior to school, and perhaps involving parents in a more concerted effort to be conscious about what they do with their children after school. So a much more holistic kind of community approach in terms of physical fitness, because there's a danger with this that physical fitness will be physical education will be reduced to a physical fitness, which wouldn't be the correct way of perceiving the whole picture.
And what is the difference between physical fitness and physical education?
Well, physical fitness, I suppose, could be perceived as something that is very much related to cardiovascular health, and it's very much tied in, I guess, with the obesity agenda and the children being overweight, whereas physical education is much broader, encompasses areas of learning for children such as social skills, communication skills, leadership skills, etc. So it's much broader, and to reduce a PE curriculum to just physical fitness would, I feel, be narrowing it hugely, and therefore making the experience for children maybe not as enjoyable as it could be.
And yet the concern among people is that there is this obesity time bomb, it has even been referred to as. So surely physical education can contribute towards helping that.
It can, it definitely can, but I think if it's the main focus of a physical education curriculum, then it leaves the curriculum very empty in terms of, for example, if we had no obese or overweight children in this country, would we then be satisfied to have a PE curriculum that's just driven by a fitness agenda as opposed to a much broader perspective of what physical education means?
So in practical terms then, if I wanted to ensure that my children got a physical education and they were physically fit, what could I do?
As a teacher,
or as a principal?
As a principal. Well, I think that a principal would have to make sure that there was a whole school approach to dedicated physical education time within curriculum time and to address all areas of the physical education curriculum, but that the school would also have a very positive physical activity approach, which would include that physical fitness concept that Senator Coughlan spoke about and that whole idea of physical fitness. So again, that there would be other time, again, during perhaps recreation time, after school and prior to school, where that type of thing could happen, or even incidentally during the school day, but that a physical education lesson, in my opinion, should not just be reduced to physical fitness or a 15-minute run around the yard.
So it's more than bringing in the army to do a boot camp in the school?
Absolutely. Yeah.
How could a principal or a school, teachers in a school, how can they assess whether or not their physical education programme is increasing children's fitness in the school?
It's a very difficult question to answer, and it's quite controversial, Sean, in the sense that in order to measure such physical fitness outcomes, the testing, I suppose, that would have to take place in terms of evaluating something like that would be things like bleep tests. And
What's a bleep test?
Sorry, a bleep test is a physical fitness test which involves running, normally done with adolescents, but that children could possibly do. Or the idea of a pedometer, which is how many steps children perhaps are taking within a day. But and again, there's also measuring body fat and things like that. But that would be, as you could imagine, something quite controversial to bring in to a school setting in terms of measuring those kind of outcomes. So if we wanted scientific evidence, going down that road would be something that would be highly controversial. And I'm not quite sure how valuable in terms of primary education that would actually be. So it's not something that has been measured very clearly. Some research would have shown that physical education lessons do provide very strong physical activity opportunities, but to measure these can be very difficult. And things like what are called a slow play technique, where children's moderate to vigorous physical activity levels are monitored using a clicking system whereby the children might be running for certain periods of time, can be used, and heart rate monitors. But to do that with 4 to 7 or 8, 12 year olds is very tricky to get young, because children move so much during the day. So it's very technical and quite tricky. So I wouldn't be an advocate of perhaps bringing in something like those kinds of measures in terms of children's physical activity levels.
And that was Catriona Cosgrave. And Catriona is chairperson of the Irish Primary PE Association. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website insideed.com. Upstart, Friends, Foes and Founding University is the title of a new book by Ed Walsh, the former president of NIHE Limerick, which subsequently became the University of Limerick. Ed Walsh also wrote an article in last Friday's Irish Times titled 13 Lessons We Need to Learn. I wanted to find out more about his work in Limerick and about his ideas for education. I began our conversation by noting that he had recently been named as one of the 50 most influential people in Irish education in an Irish Times list. I asked him what he believed his influence on Irish education is or has been.
Well, I was surprised to see that, because obviously I'm on the fringes of it now. I'm stepped down after 28 years at the University of Limerick, or the NIHE Limerick. I stepped down in 1998. 28 years was long enough. But I suppose the NIHE Limerick in the 1970s and 80s had a fairly profound effect on Irish higher education. You see, in 1970, January 1970, when I came back to Ireland to chair the planning board for the proposed Institute of Higher Education in Limerick, two things were happening. One was the country was starting to industrialize. Lemass and then Jack Lynch with Brendan O'Regan and people like Paul Quigley in the Shannon Free Airport development zone were offering no corporate tax to attract industry in. And industry was coming in, finding that they could get assembly line workers off the land, but they were very short of the kind of people who would manage, and they couldn't find the right scientists or engineers and so on. So the government decided to respond to this, and I got the opportunity, really. I wasn't very creative. I just picked a system from North America that worked, because the American universities, unlike the European universities, have three missions, teaching and research, but they have a third mission, service to the community. So I had spent the previous 9 years in the United States, and I saw the way in which the universities helped the communities develop. And so I just introduced this North American system, and it was alien to Europe. It was alien to Ireland, and especially in Ireland, because the universities had been starved, really, since the state was established, and there were sleepy places and not responding to the new Ireland that was starting to develop. So, yes, we did in the 1970s, 1980s, we woke up the system.
As UL is today, what would you be most proud of about it that you can trace back to something that you saw in the distance of the 1970s that has materialised today?
Well, what has materialised, of course, was the Celtic Tiger. And we brought in the first wave of high-tech industries that did very sophisticated things in Ireland. I mentioned Analog Devices doing silicon chips. Wang came in. They were the first people to make small little computers. Westinghouse, the whole succession. And then, of course, the Intels and the Microsofts and the Googles followed. But we demonstrated to the multinationals that Irish young people were well-educated and were smart and had no nonsense about the old British disease of industrial relations. They got on with the job. Most of the multinationals that came in were non-unionized plants. And the graduates from the University of Limerick had no hang-ups about this. In fact, of course, they were being paid much more than they might be if they were in a unionized plant. And so we played the key role in the late 70s, early 80s, in demonstrating that Ireland could support sophisticated enterprise. And, of course, hugely important was the fact that we stimulated the traditional universities to move on and to do a lot of the things that they said they wouldn't do. And indeed, later on, we're claiming that they were doing them for the first time. So we had an influence on the whole university system, and we had a profound interest, impact on demonstrating that Ireland was a good place in which to invest. Now, as time has moved on, NIHE and University of Limerick has changed, and we have learned from the older universities than they have learned from us. And there isn't a great deal of difference, I suppose, in our ethos.
And now, if we take the other side of it then, you were at the helm for 28 years. Can you identify a mistake that you made that had far-reaching consequences?
Yeah. Probably that I didn't oppose the integration of the colleges of education into the university. I was approached that they would be integrated for very good reasons, and I accepted those that they wanted
this
to bring.
This is Thomond College and
Mary Immaculate, that they bring teacher education into the mainstream of the university. But our ethos, and I was very much involved in selecting the people who came into NIHE Limerick and then the University of Limerick, our ethos was very different from the traditional universities, very different from that in the colleges of education. And I very foolishly gave both Thomond and Mary Immaculate a full-run membership of the Academic Council, membership of the Executive Board, and so on, the faculty boards. And that diluted our mission. And we started doing fringy things which were not of direct benefit to
the... What kind of things do you mean by fringy?
Fringy things from women's studies to topics in the arts that would, where Trinity and NUI would run circles around us. We should have stuck to our last and focused on those areas that where we were winning.
And looking back, say, at how visionary setting up NIHE was and the huge effort it required to bring it to fruition, what do you think that Irish education needs today that would be as visionary for now and as worthwhile as the NIHE, now the University of Limerick, became?
Yeah, we have a huge liability with our school system, not because the students aren't smart, but they're getting a very old-fashioned approach. Singapore, for example, once it was recognized that the knowledge economy was different to the industrial manufacturing economy, completely rejigged its school system. And we need a profound change in the school system, and I hope Minister Quinn will go about doing that. The colleges of primary education need a huge transformation. You know, it's quite extraordinary that the primary teachers for the public school system are educated in colleges, and the board of these colleges is presided over by a bishop.
But that hardly, though, affects the standard or the quality of the education. It may, you know, affect the ethos of the teachers, which will feed into the schools. But in terms of, say, worry about PISA results and things like that,
yeah,
the ethos is hardly going to be...
The ethos is important in that we teach a lot of religion to our primary teachers, and we don't teach enough of civics. We didn't expose them enough to science and mathematics. But the McKinsey report, in analyzing why some countries always get high gradings in the PISA score, identified very vividly that the most important element of the school system is, and it's no surprise if you think about it, is the quality of the teacher. And the countries that excel in terms of world school systems excel not because the country spends a great deal of money on the schools or a great deal of money on the teacher salaries. They spend a reasonable amount, but not as much as we do in Ireland. These schools excel Finland, South Korea, Singapore, Canada, Japan, and now Poland coming into the thing. They focus on the quality of the teachers, and they're very fussy about who they permit to be teachers. They restrict the numbers very harshly to the numbers of teachers that are required. They've made teaching an elite profession. They consider it the country's most important profession, because you entrust to teachers the responsibility of transferring knowledge and attitudes from one generation to the next generation.
But if we did that here, wouldn't people say we were, you know, if we restricted teacher numbers, for example, and say didn't accept people from other European Union countries, or, you know, they'd say we were being kind of anti-competitive?
I'd welcome teachers from other European countries, but you can very carefully predict how many primary teachers you need or how many secondary teachers you need. And in those countries that excel, they just limit the number of teachers permitted, so that, in fact, people, when they get a teaching place, they become as excited as getting a place in medicine or dentistry. And then once the teachers are admitted, after a very carefully structured program, young teachers are just not left to their own. They're put under the wing of older teachers. And when the students go home, as school is out, the teachers don't go home. They remain on for quite some time afterwards, and they work full days. And the time after school is spent really in considering how the quality of the teaching can be improved. The other important point found by McKinsey, the first one is you're very fussy about the people you permit to teach, and then you look after them well in terms of their development, and then you assess them and you make school grades known. The second thing is you never let a student fall behind between one day and the next. So that in many of these countries, a teacher is obliged at the end of the day, if it's 3 o'clock, to look around and see John and Mary and Joe. Look, would you stay behind, please? Because I don't think you were following that new bit of mathematics we were doing. And so the teachers remain with the students at the end of the day to ensure that by tomorrow morning they have caught up with the class. And I mean, this is obvious, certainly in science and mathematics, that if you have lost, if you don't understand one of the steps along the route, you can't, you're most unlikely to understand the other steps that depend on it. So there are things like that can be done without expending additional funding. We need to extend the school year and make it as long as the European average. We need to expect that teachers will work, and I would hope that they would have the public sector norm now of some 30 days holidays, and that they would use the time between terms to take in service education and to ensure that they are involved in moving the curriculum along to keep pace with the demands of the knowledge society.
And so do you think the main change then has to come in the formation of the teachers, or is it in the practice in schools?
Well, the formation of the teachers, of course, is a very important matter in the long term. But in the short term, one could do a wide variety of things to change. For example, we know that some 40% higher of our maths teachers are not qualified to teach mathematics. And the certainty of turning kids off in a subject of mathematics or chemistry or physics is if the teacher isn't quite sure exactly what's happening or can't relate it to the world of work. So I would suggest now that we have 400,000 people unemployed that we should be bringing in especially university graduates as adjuncts into the school system, science graduates, mathematics graduates and others, to help leaven the quality of the teaching in the school system. In fact, there is a volunteer system in the United States and in the UK where young people, whether they have employment prospects or not, can volunteer to return a little to society by going into the schools as adjuncts and working with the teachers.
This is Teach for America.
That's exactly, Teach for America, and I think they have a Teach for Britain also. How about Teach for Ireland?
But these people, they go into schools and they don't have an education qualification. So they don't know, say, how to actually, they may have the subject matter knowledge, but they may not know how to help students learn it.
The Teach for America program, I believe, has a preliminary program of some months before before these people go in. It's well established. And there's a whole lot of old nonsense about pedagogics and so on. The higher diploma is not a very stimulating a program. So, we need to get on with it and just be pragmatic. There are lots of things we can do to stimulate the existing school system and to prepare future teachers for a new school system.
You were appointed by Gemma Hussey to be chair of the Curriculum and Examinations Board back in the 80s. What was that experience like?
Well, it was a bit depressing because I said to Gemma when she asked me to chair it, I said, who are you going to put on the board? Well, she said, I have a small group of wonderful people. They're excellent teachers. And I said, that's great. And they proved to be. They're wonderful people. But in addition, she put on the heads of the teacher unions. And in their own right, they were fine individuals, but their mission was not to, their mission, I suppose, put it positively, was to ensure that the interests of the teaching, of the teachers themselves were looked after. And these people were very experts in negotiating the pay and conditions of teachers. Now, it turned out that when proposals came forward for radical change to the curriculum, that there were a great deal of difficulties in some cases in convincing these union leaders that they made sense. They might have made sense in terms of developing the curriculum system, but they were vetoed very often by the representatives who felt that they would disrupt the lifestyle of the teachers. So in one fell swoop, Minister Quinn, and he's going to be a fine minister, they could, without any cost, hugely improve the process of curriculum development by removing the union leaders from the curriculum and the NCCA. That's not their place. They're very fine people, and they should be certainly negotiating pay and conditions. But the unions should not determine what's taught in the schools.
One of the reasons we're talking today is because of the publishing of your memoir or autobiography? Memoir?
It's a memoir. I kept a diary during the 28 years. And whenever something significant was happening or foolish or nasty, I wrote it down in some detail. And there are lots of funny incidents and stupid incidents and nasty incidents. And so the book is called Upstart, Friends, Foes, and Founding University. It's published by the Collins Press. And I worked with a man who worked for the Irish Times, Kieran Fagan, and the two of us extracted from about 500,000 words I dictated for the archives, about 120,000 words, an enormous-sized book, where we just extracted the strange, hilarious, stupid, awful activities of real life that take place behind the scenes. And
and you do name names.
And I do name names, and I'm told it's a page-turner. It's not an academic work at all. But on many occasions, we had lots of fun. On other occasions, when UCC, for example, and the NUI got an opportunity to disembowel us, they very nearly did. were it not for the students who went in front of the NUI office in Merrion Square and burnt matriculation forms and burnt Minister Burke's effigy on O'Connell's Bridge, we might indeed have been brought to our knees by the traditional universities that really behaved most extraordinarily badly in trying to prevent Limerick and of course, subsequently NIHE Dublin getting off the ground.
The title of your book is Upstart, and you're from Cork. Are you a born rebel?
Some people might think I am, but I suppose my 9 years in the States made me very frustrated with the way in which we mess around in Ireland, especially in education. The Department of Education needs a major change, and the way we do things in education policy needs a major change. And I think Minister Quinn is a bit of a rebel himself, and I hope he's going to shake things up.
We began, Ed, by talking about your being listed as one of the top 50 most influential people in Irish education. If we go look at Irish education today, who do you think is the most influential?
Well, obviously, I think Rory Quinn is a great guy, and he's at the top of the heap. And times of crisis are times for making change and making the right change. And I have a list of some 12 initiatives in education that might be taken, and I think 11 out of the 12 don't involve any expenditure. So Minister Quinn is, of course, the most influential person in education, and he really can make huge amount of change without going to the Minister for Finance looking for any money. In fact, he could save money by making some of these changes. I think we have some very good university heads. In a very quiet way, the Don Barry, who heads up the University of Limerick, has it's shown, in fact, that the employment rates out of Limerick are way up at the top, that it is ranked as a very innovative university. I think UCD has been woken up by its excellent president. And there's a very fine, and I'm naming names, the new president of DCU is a very fine person. But Minister Quinn is there, and really it's at the stroke of a pen he can make so much change. Foolishly, I think he constrained himself on the fees issue because university building, universities that get up and stay amongst the top 100 is an international competition, and competition in the knowledge economy is a race for talent. And if we can't financially compete for some of the world's best people, the quality of our universities is going to decline.
And that was Dr. Ed Walsh, former president of the University of Limerick. His book, Upstart, Friends, Foes and Founding University, is published by the Collins Press and is available from Easons for €28. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email us at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to my guests on this week's programme, Katrina Cosgrave from the Merino Institute of Education, and to Ed Walsh. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.